From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the Persian puzzle. Iran, Iraq, and the United States. The U.S. airstrike, which killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani last week, has prompted fears of a serious escalation in the region. Iran has already vowed to avenge the killing.
This temporary joy of the Americans and the Israelis will not last long before it turns to grief. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the people of Iran, and the Front of Resistance throughout the geographic latitude of the Islamic world will take revenge of this proud martyr.
Soleimani was the head of the elite Quds Force and Iran's top intelligence commander. The United States says he trained and equipped Iraqi insurgents with the means to make the bombs which killed hundreds of American soldiers during the Iraq War.
Retired General David Petraeus, who commanded American forces during the war in Iraq, called Soleimani our most significant and evil adversary in the greater Middle East. Seen as a terrorist in the U.S., Soleimani was respected in Iran and tried to reshape its influence in the region.
But Soleimani also had detractors in Iraq, including many thousands of demonstrators who had taken to the streets in recent months to protest Iran's growing influence in Iraq's political affairs.
They see this government as having too much influence from Iran, and they want that to stop.
A recent report published jointly by The New York Times and The Intercept used hundreds of leaked Iranian intelligence documents to outline just how deep that influence runs. New York Times reporter Farnaz Fasihi was a member of the investigative team that brought the leaked cables to light. She's also the author of the book Waiting for an Ordinary Day, a memoir of her 4 years covering the Iraq War. I spoke to her back in November.
Farnaz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by asking you how these cables, these leaked documents, were obtained.
The cables were leaked to The Intercept through a secure channel by a source whose identity was not revealed and is not clear to us. The only thing that the source said was that I'm sharing these documents because I want the world to know what Iran is doing in my country. So presumably they're Iraqi, but we were not able to convince the source to meet with us or speak to any of the reporters.
So this is a joint Intercept New York Times project to dig into these documents, to understand them and to verify them. How long did that project take?
This project's been in the works for over a year because these cables needed to be translated. There were 700 pages of Persian cables written in Farsi. And also The Intercept and The New York Times tried to verify the authenticity of them. And after they verified it through independent sourcing, then came the task of reporters going through these cables and reading them and trying to understand some of the revelations here and then, basically decide what the narrative threat here is in all these documents.
So Farnaz, obviously a number of editors and reporters from both The Intercept and The New York Times worked on this. Can you explain to us how they went about verifying that or authenticating the documents?
I think that revealing how these documents were authenticated is something the editors of the project should address. But the documents are very meticulous. They are all numbered. All the documents individually have numbers. They're dated. They are in formal sort of Persian communication because I've seen the cables in Farsi and I've seen a lot of Iranian government documents and these look authentic to me. And they're also signed at the bottom by the name of the intelligence agents who were handling or were writing the reports. They're not just from Baghdad. They're from different cities across Iraq as they were gathering the intelligence. Some are from Baghdad, some are from the south, some are from the Kurdish areas. And there's an incredible amount of detail, not just on the day-to-day operation, but on the background of the sources that the Iranians were cultivating, on the background of the Iraqi officials, the life story of some of the Iraqi CIA agents that Iran was trying to recruit as double agents or turn around. And, these details are things that make the documents more extraordinary. Also, there are mundane things like receipts and expense reports and just the day-to-day business of intelligence gathering.
You've worked in the region for a number of years. How common is it to get intelligence reports from Iran?
This is unprecedented. Iran is one of the most secretive countries in the world to penetrate its intelligence apparatus. In the 40 years history of the Islamic Republic, a breach of intelligence document like this is unprecedented. This is the first of its kind. This is the first time that we get a glimpse at how Iran has gone about extending its influence, how it's gone about trying to have a dominant role in the region in terms of its military strategy, political strategy, and intelligence gathering, not just to know what the Iraqis were up to, but more importantly, what the Americans were doing.
Before we get into the documents, mm-hmm. can you describe the relationship between Iran and Iraq before the U.S. invasion in 2003?
So Iran and Iraq had fought a war for 8 years in the 1980s, soon after the Iranian Revolution. Saddam Hussein was considered one of Iran's top enemies, and Sunnis were really the dominant power in Iraq, and Shias were marginalized. So while you had a state in Iraq that was very hostile to Iran, you also had an Iraqi minority that was being oppressed, and an Iraqi opposition that was very naturally aligned to Iran, right? You had the Badr Brigade and the Hakim movement and various Iraqi Shia clerics and politicians and even the Kurds who were close to Iran because they all had a common enemy in Saddam. And those alliances, as we see in these documents, really came to Iran's aid. You know, the documents reveal that a number of top Iraqi politicians and Kurdish politicians, including the current prime minister of Iraq, Adel Abdel Mahdi, have very close ties to Iran. Those ties started before the American invasion, years before the U.S. invasion.
Okay, so now after the invasion, the Americans make a number of choices, one of which is to not really work on nation building. How did that have an impact?
Well, I think the U.S. was so out of depth. I was the Baghdad bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal in those early days after the invasion, and we could see that, you know, some of the most basic needs of the Iraqi population, like electricity, like water, like municipal services, like healthcare, were abandoned by the Americans because they were busy trying to build a nation from scratch, build an army from scratch, and try to quell this insurgency that had almost immediately started against them and attacking U.S. bases and soldiers and car bombs and the U.N. and, you know, they really failed to bring the Iraqi society up to some basic level of standards that they could feel like there was some benefit from this war.
And how did Iran exploit that vacuum?
Iran exploited that vacuum by working through its network of Shia politicians who were rising to power, by working through the Shia religious centers and the mosques and offering services to the population, by sending doctors and nurses and teachers and however way they could. That was the surface of it. But as these documents reveal, Iran also dispatched its top intelligence people who were both employees of the Ministry of Information and the Revolutionary Guard's intelligence apparatus.
Why was it so important to Iran to know exactly what was going on in Iraq?
There were two reasons. President George Bush had declared Iran as part of an axis of evil. It had just toppled the Taliban in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein in Iran. And Iranian leaders really believed that Tehran was next on Washington's list of regimes to topple. They were very nervous about having American bases set up around them in Afghanistan, in Kuwait, in Qatar, and now in Iraq, right next door. So they wanted to find out what the Americans were up to. It was survival for the regime. So that was one component. The other component was that they saw Iraq as a gateway for their regional dominance. They saw it as a natural geographical gateway to Syria and Lebanon because it would really connect Iran to its other allies, Hezbollah in Lebanon and Bashar Assad in Syria.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you were Baghdad bureau chief at the time of the invasion, and that basic needs of Iraqis weren't being met. How did that change over time?
The regular day-to-day life of Iraqis unraveled year after year, month after month. It didn't get better for years and years. And in fact, it got worse. By the peak of the civil war, 2005, 2006, 2007, Iraqis could not step out of the house and not worry that they were going to get blown up. They were worried about sending their kids to school and not having them come back. It was that kind of violent, day-to-day, unpredictable security situation combined with really lack of basic services, without electricity, without healthcare, without clean water. And that's why, you know, millions of Iraqis left Iraq. And we had, in 2006, 2007, you know, a refugee crisis of Iraqis leaving, going to Syria, going to Jordan, trying to come to the U.S. So life for Iraqis did not really improve in those early years after the fall of Saddam. And they blamed the U.S.
So the Iranian intelligence agencies and intelligence officers, they move in at this point. Mm-hmm. How did they cultivate assets in Iraq?
Well, what we've seen from the cables is that they tried to cultivate assets by going after Iraqis who they thought were loyal to them. This is Shia politicians or Kurdish politicians or Shia religious clerics. They also tried to recruit Iraqis who were spying for the U.S., for the CIA. And in one incident that we referred to, there was an Iraqi who American handlers called him Donnie Bresco, and he flips and he becomes an agent for the Iranians, and they refer to him with a number. The other remarkable thing that these documents reveal is that Iran was not only just getting information from its recruits and spies, but it was getting debriefed by Iraqi officials, very senior Iraqi officials. They would meet with the Americans, with the ambassador, with the American military officials, and the next day they would go and debrief the Iranians on what the U.S. had told them, on American strategy. In one incident in these cables, a top Iraqi military intelligence person comes to the Iranians and says, the Americans have given us very sophisticated surveillance software, spying software, and if you like, we can share this with you. Give me a new laptop and I will download this for you. They've given us this equipment that we can track cell phones and location, and we take it to the U.S. Embassy to update it once a week. If you like, I can also share that with you. So not just intelligence reports, but actual spyware and American intelligence equipment was going from the U.S. to Iranians by way of Iraqis. And that's quite extraordinary.
So if you were to look at it as an espionage game, were the Iranians besting the United States at that game?
Absolutely. I think that we had anecdotal evidence, people who, like me, spent time in Iran, that Iran had the upper hand in Iraq. And now these documents show that Iranians really outmaneuvered the U.S. at every turn.
Tell me, you mentioned him very briefly, but can you tell us a little bit more about the asset that they dubbed Donnie Bresco?
So Donnie Bresco had worked for the CIA. That was his American handler nickname. And in 2014, he became terrified of his ties to the Americans. And he went to the Iranians for protection and flipped sides. He told the Iranians that he knew what kind of intelligence the Americans were gathering in Iraq. He could sell it to them. He knew the locations of CIA safe houses, the names of hotels where CIA operatives stayed and met with Iraqi agents in Iraq, details of what kind of training and weapons the Americans were giving to Iraqis. And he names Iraqis who were working for the Americans as spies. Now, we've left these details out, right? The cables that we've seen, we have and I've seen, reveal these details. There's the names of the Iraqis, the names of the hotels, the names of the locations, specific street addresses. Cell phone numbers of these Iraqis are all written in these cables, right? He was doing this for $3,000 a month, plus a $20,000 bonus, a car, and a certificate from the Americans for his good work. And he comes to the Iranians saying, I've switched sides. I'm not telling the Americans anything. But if you protect me and you put me on the payroll, I will give you all I have. And in the cables, the Iranians are kind of not sure whether to trust him, and at the end determine that, well, let's put this guy on a 6-month probation and see what he can give us.
So the Donnie Bresco story takes place in 2014. So that's 3 years after the U.S. draws down troops in 2011. How did that shift in 2011. How did that have an impact on Iran's influence?
It created another vacuum for Iran to maneuver in Iraq. When the Americans left in 2011, they let go of some of their Iraqi spies. These were Iraqi men who had been on the payroll of the CIA and, you know, had relied on this, on the protection and security that the Americans offered and the money that they offered. It can be really a kiss of death to be known as a CIA handler in Iraq. And they were scared. And the Americans suddenly left and said, you're on your own. So what did these people do? They turned to Iran. And Iran recruits them for simple things like gold coins, pistachios, saffron, paid vacations to Iran, and money.
Pistachios?
Pistachios. Iranian pistachios are very good, by the way.
That may be, but I mean, I hadn't heard of them being used as a form of payment in the past.
Exactly. I think this is something that the recruits were asking for, pistachio and saffron. I think in one of the cables, actually, one of the Iraqi officials tells the Iranian agent that he's running out of Persian saffron and he would like to stock up again.
You and your co-authors write that many of the cables describe real-life espionage capers that feel torn from the pages of a spy thriller. Can you give us a few more details along those lines?
So some of these documents show that the Iranians were meeting their Iraqi sources and their recruits in dark alleyways and sometimes in shopping malls as they were pretending to shop or they were pretending to host a birthday party. They staged a hunting excursion as sort of a cover for intelligence gathering. They would sort of lurk around Iraqi airport to take pictures of American officials and soldiers coming and going. And, you know, what military flights, coalition flights entered and left Iraq. And also bribes. I have to mention bribes. There's one cable that says that the Iranians gave $16 million to an Iraqi lawmaker, a very influential one, who then helped them secure a $250 million development deal in Iraq.
May I ask you what the Iraqi response has been to this?
So the Iraqi officials, of course, this report's very embarrassing for them. Some of it they've dismissed and said that these incidents, such as offering Iraq's military intelligence to Iranians and debriefing them after meeting with Americans, is false. They've denied it. Mr. Adel Abdelmahdi's people have said, well, you know, everyone knows that he's close to the Iranians and this is not a revelation. And the Iranians, I think we've met silence from them. They have not commented. I think it's because of what's happening in Iran, and they're very preoccupied with trying to crush this uprising in Iran.
And so have you had a response then from the Americans?
I haven't seen any official response, but some of our sources say that what this report lays out is in line with their own findings and what they already know to be true.
So this story came out at an unusual moment. Iraqis are protesting in enormous numbers across the country. How do these protests relate to Iran's involvement in Iraq?
So, you know, as the documents show and as we've discussed, the Iranians for almost two decades since the fall of Saddam have strategized to turn Iraq into a client state. And more or less, they've been successful. The protests in the past couple of weeks have really turned the table on Iran. We've seen Iraqis burn the Iranian flag. We've seen them call for Iran to leave their country, for their politicians to end their ties or be ousted because of their ties to Iran. And we've really, even amongst the Shias, whom were typically loyal to Iran, we've seen this real anger toward Iran and a sense of sort of Iraqi nationalism prevailing because they're tired of corruption and things not improving, security not improving, and they've now turned their anger to their government and because of the government's ties to Iran, to Iran.
How is Iran responding?
Well, Iran dispatched its top force commander, General Qasem Soleimani, to Iraq in mid-October for crisis management. He went there to convince Prime Minister Adel Abdelmahdi not to resign and to keep his government in place because it's a friendly government to Iran. And he went there to try to help the Iraqis manage the protests.
And of course, there are protests in Iran as well for largely different reasons. But in both cases, where do you think they will go?
It's hard to tell. The Iraqi protests have endured. It's now weeks of this. The Iranian protests, it looks now like riots and uprising against the regime rather than just protests against the economy. They were sparked by an increase in gasoline prices, but they really very quickly turned into widespread grievances against the entire regime. With a lot of destruction and burning down of banks and government buildings and tearing down Ayatollah Khamenei's photos. And there's been a lot of violence. Almost over 100 people have been killed, hundreds injured. My prediction, if we look at the precedent of Iranian protests and uprisings, is that the government will crack down with an iron fist and try to crush this. Even if the protests in Iraq and in Iran are crushed, they display a serious and new level of anger at both the Iranian government and the Iraqi government. And that's something that both governments may be able to crush now, but it's not going to go away because the underlying reasons for that anger are not going to be addressed or resolved. So we might have a situation of a powder keg situation where anything that happens could very easily make both places erupt again.
So you mentioned that Soleimani actually went into Iraq earlier this fall. What role has he played throughout in this story?
General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds forces, is the face of the Revolutionary Guard's interests and strategy in the Middle East. He has had a front-center role in conflicts and policies in Syria, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in its fight wars with Israel, and in Iraq. Specifically in Iraq, Mr. Soleimani has been making multiple trips for crisis management over the past 20 years. The Iraqis called on him to help them maneuver an American occupation. They called on him to help them overcome a Sunni insurgency. They sought his advice, and he had a very central commanding role in the formation of the Shia militia, who were instrumental in fighting ISIS in Iraq. And now again, facing with a crisis of legitimacy, the Iraqi government has again called on General Soleimani to go to Iraq and save them. In some of these cables, there's one incident where General Soleimani goes to the head of Iraqi intelligence and asks him to allow Iranian planes to go through Iraqi airspace to Syria to transport weapons. And the Iraqi official walks over and kisses General Soleimani's forehead and says, "We will give you whatever you need." There's another incident where an Iraqi intelligence official tells the Iranians that all of Iraq's military intelligence is yours for the asking.
Now that you've seen these documents and you've helped work on this report, how does this change the way you see Iran in the region, in Yemen, for example, in Syria, in Lebanon? Has it shifted in some way the way you perceive of Iran in the region?
It has. I've been documenting Iran's doings and actions in the region for years, both in Syria and Yemen and Lebanon and elsewhere. But I've never had this kind of insight into how they go about doing this. And I think that the documents provide us a narrow window from 2013 to 2015 in Iraq. But if we take what we see, we can definitely apply it to every theater where Iran has an interest to gather intelligence, like the Shia parts of Saudi Arabia.
What about this role of the United States in the region? Obviously, you've mentioned that Iran exploited opportunities to step in where the Americans were not. One of which is, as you mentioned, but also is laid out in the report, that the CIA's assets after the CIA leaves are left to fend for themselves. Has that highlighted something for you that you'd seen before?
The documents reveal that U.S. policy did not succeed in delivering the goals of either bringing democracy or even bringing stability in the region and curtailing Iran's influence and power. The Trump administration has made Iran a big foreign policy issue. It exited the nuclear deal. It has imposed sanctions on Iran's oil and on the Revolutionary Guards. And one of their stated goals of Washington is to curb Iran's influence in the region. There's a tendency by more hawkish policymakers to dismiss Iran as a renegade, irrational, crazy state that, you know, is very impulsive. But these documents actually reveal that Iran is a formidable enemy and challenge for the United States because its intelligence gathering and its operations are very sophisticated. There's a lot of strategy behind what they do and a big picture look at their interests in the region. So I think if you're a policymaker in Washington or a military strategist, you would look at these documents and think that if the U.S. plans to invade another country in the Middle East, it really needs to reconsider what it can actually achieve.
Farnaz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was the New York Times reporter Farnaz Fasihi. Fasihi is also the author of the book Waiting for an Ordinary Day, a memoir of her 4 years covering the Iraq War and witnessing the unraveling of life for Iraqi citizens. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Benjamin Soloway and Anis Modi. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. Then tweet about it, tell your friends, and come back next week. We'll have a new episode.